bonus special episode of Another Look commencing right now. Hey, Corey.
Here we go. Hey, Will, what's up? What did we do? What are we talking about?
This is a fun, not off the beaten path. We're still talking about movies. Movies, of course. We're talking about the Milwaukee Film Festival, the 2024 Milwaukee Film Festival.
So cool.
It ran from April 11th to the 25th.
Yeah.
And we got press passes. We were lucky enough to get press passes and to explore a good variety of the films. Mm-hmm. So we're here going to be talking about it. We have a couple audio excerpts from different interviews and Q&As we overheard and were laid witness to. We get to talk about some of the movies we watched and our thoughts on them. And so, you know, this is going to be a pretty brief, lax podcast, mm-hmm. maybe even less preparation than we usually do, I mm-hmm. feel. Mm-hmm. But that means it's off the cuff. That means it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit chill. So we're going to talk about some of the movies.
It was quite a whirlwind.
It really was. I saw 11 films. How many did you end up seeing?
I think only four or five. Yeah. I missed a couple that I wanted to go to.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, hey, 4 or 5 is better than 0.
Yep. I was responsible and I did the stuff that I had to do instead of going to the movies.
Right. So. Yeah. As much as this is part of our, I don't know, our public facing, our lifestyle or whatever. Yeah. And it is something that we do. It isn't a job. So as much as mm-hmm. we wanted to, there were some people, they were raising their hands at the closing night film, which was Robot Dreams.
Sure.
And the closing night film, you know, it's always packed. The balcony was open at the Oriental Theater, which is a great movie palace of the Milwaukee area. And Milwaukee Film owns that. And now they just recently reopened the Downer Theater, which is like a small 2-screen neighborhood theater.
It's even older than the Oriental, which I didn't know, which mm-hmm. is cool.
We're so lucky to have those open again and to be showing quality films. There was, you know, one of the programmers raising their hand, talking about how many people have seen, you know, like 10 films at the festival. And so many people raised their hand.
Wow.
How about 15? So many people.
Damn.
There were people raising their hands past 50 films.
Oh my God.
Which is like every day of the festival, probably at least seeing 2 to 3.
Wow.
Has to be maybe 3 movies a day.
Yeah, because how many were there total? Like 300 films or something?
Yeah,
right?
So it's like, I mean, it's physically impossible to see them all. But it is a possibility to see at least 3 or 4 films a day if you play your cards right. So, and then that is for 2 weeks. So,
mm-hmm. and the shorts programs mm-hmm. and stuff too, that's like each one of those counts as its own one.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, people were, oh my gosh, they were just bouncing off the walls, ready to talk about how many movies they saw. But I mean, yeah, I feel like we got a good mix. There were a lot of things this year that I was excited about, and it was great to see them. So
yeah, there's a great variety. Really, it was a lot of stuff that I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
A few of the things, like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari with like a live accompaniment was really cool. That was unfortunately one I missed, but... Mm-hmm. They played The Passion of Joan of Arc a few years back with mm-hmm. the live accompaniment, and I was all there for that. I love that stuff, too, like those special event ones
mm-hmm.
with the orchestras. But yeah, pretty much everything that was playing was totally new to me. So that was pretty fun to, like, we would talk about some of the ones we want to try to hit up, and I would forget what we're doing
mm-hmm.
and I was loving going into all the movies just not knowing what they were about.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about the film festival is that you can really walk in as blind as you want. You can see a trailer, you can read a synopsis, you can even just look at an image and, you know, see that kind of looks interesting. Or you could just be looking at the schedule, especially with us, we had press passes and we're like, hey, what's after that movie that I could stick around for? Oh, it's that. Let's mm-hmm. go see that. Mm-hmm. So it really gives you a lot of freedom as to what we were looking to watch and also what we were open to seeing. Like, I definitely wouldn't have seen a movie like, I don't think I had even heard of a movie called Riddle of Fire beforehand.
Oh, yeah.
But we ended up seeing it at the Oriental Theater with a 35mm print, and that was one of the standouts of the festival. So, like, these things kind of come and go when you watch at a festival, especially one like Milwaukee Film where For those who aren't really aware of Wisconsin culture, the Milwaukee Film Festival isn't necessarily one with a lot of big premieres. It's also not a festival that like runs in the middle of awards season and like you have people there campaigning. Like when I was at the Santa Barbara Film Festival pre-pandemic, that's a festival where you're mainly like celebrities are there to campaign the current movie they're in. So like Viggo Mortensen was there promoting Green Book. Glenn Close was there promoting, I think, The Wife. Paul Schrader was there promoting First Reformed. So like
cool.
A lot of those filmmakers and actors and directors and all that, you know, those type of festivals, it's not that either. So it's not about really necessarily the awards. It's more about bringing a good eclectic connection to cinema to the local area, which is fantastic.
That
so,
Santa Barbara one, when was that in the year?
That was in January of 2019.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because the Milwaukee Film Festival has also been in October.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then during the pandemic, it kind of got moved to like the springtime and it was virtual for some times. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they even did a later one more recently last year or something. Because this one now in April feels like, didn't the festival just happen?
Yeah. It kind of... for me, at least, it came up kind of unexpectedly.
Yeah.
And I was, pretty soon I realized, you know, once we were getting press passes and we were going to be able to get into it, I started flipping through the book of programming and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so many exciting things here. And it's often the only time that a lot of these films will be shown in the Milwaukee area. A lot of these films get really small distribution. They get qualifying runs in LA, New York, sometimes Chicago, but... you know, I can't drive to Chicago to see everything.
Yeah.
And as much as I would like to, it's just not feasible. So for all this, all these great films to come to Milwaukee and like really have an expansive programming list is really cool.
And a lot of stuff will eventually come through the Oriental or the Downer.
Yeah.
At some point, but then it's even more limited and then it doesn't have the like extravagance of the festival, but
for sure
the program book I think is also like a really famous part about the festival.
Yeah,
like I worked with people particularly my buddy Brad from Barnes and Noble was just always hyped when the day the program book comes out, he's getting his right away.
No, it's a fun thing to like flip through a physical like magazine essentially and like look at all the different films from the different sub program, you know, kind of headers and pick out what you want to see on what days and what can you make, what can't you make. Oh, I can't see that day because I'm seeing that, but oh, I'm going to go watch it on this day.
Yeah.
So it's a really great, it's just a festival season is fantastic. And like the fact that Milwaukee gets a really solid, impactful, local festival is super important. I've never been to the Wisconsin Film Festival on Madison, but they get cool stuff. I've never been to the Chicago Film Fest, but I've heard amazing things about that. And they do get some like some high profile films once in a while. So you know, it's great to just like have all everything you want to watch. It's like in this 2 week span and you kind of get to plan it all out. So
and yeah, the Milwaukee film community is like hungry for stuff.
They really are.
They just like gobble up, you know, whatever comes through. I definitely think we like the weird stuff too. Like that, I feel like attracts more people than maybe like the arty drama stuff. But you know, that's why the film festival has like such a wide variety.
Yeah, you really can see everything that you want there. Milwaukee's always been to me like, I feel like you have a late night screening of a John Carpenter film you know, something of the sort where, you know, it's like it's not off the beaten path by any means, but it is for a certain audience. That's like what gets, you know, people out to the theater of like for rep stuff, particularly. The Milwaukee Film as an organization has been doing a Hitchcock retrospective, and I've heard that's been going well. So
They're gonna play To Catch a Thief.
Hell yeah,
in Vista Vision.
That's what we're talking about. We're talking about movies that, you know, we're ahead of the curve.
I'd love to go see that.
We're the first people to ever recommend To Catch a Thief. But let's get into some of the films, shall we?
Yeah.
The first film we saw together was The Sweet East.
Yes.
So this was a film that has been making the rounds on like a roadshow type experience. I think the initial releases was in November of last year. Mm. So it's relatively new. But the fact that Milwaukee Film got it for the festival is really great. It was shown on a 35 millimeter print,
so cool,
which is also making the rounds to different, you know, kind of art house theaters, those type of venues. The writer of the film, the screenwriter, Nick Pinkerton, who's also a fabulous critic, writes for Reverse Shot, Film Comment, you know,
cool
things, outlets like that. He wrote the movie and he was there for a Q&A. So we got to see the movie. This was a good start to the festival, I thought. I really enjoyed this movie. What'd you think of it?
I liked it a lot. It was part of the teen screen.
Yeah. So that header is, there's like a list of teen programmers who pick stuff that like resonates with them and like talks about their, like, you know, just like being of like a younger generation and that kind of experience. So an interesting choice for this program, for sure.
I really liked, hearing everybody's ideologies. You know, it kind of starts as a joke. At first, at least, I took it like, I forget the main character's name, but she...
Lillian,
she's like meeting, you know, she's meeting all these people through sort of like just kind of wandering.
Yeah.
And she's like a blank slate where she's not giving as much to these conversations as much as she's being like talked at and told what to think by these, like, you know, adults or authority people. But you know, you see her being talked at and it's kind of funny at first, where it's like you're hearing all these buzzwords or whatever, like, you know, political topics and stuff, and she's just like taking it all in and not responding. But then I start getting interested in each sect she finds herself in and hearing what they are hyped about and just what they believe, and especially those two, like the filmmakers, and how they're getting all like pretentious about art and everything. Like, I love that. It's funny. It's kind of like, you know, kicking itself in the pants or whatever, tongue in cheek or whatnot. But
totally.
But that was pretty interesting, and that was a cool movie.
Yeah, I really liked this kind of Alice in Wonderland journey through like a fractured America. You know, that's kind of what I took from it, was everybody has these, you know, everybody's in their own little bubble nowadays. And it feels like the director, Sean Price Williams, you know, takes an aesthetic, kind of this grainy, I think it was shot on 16 millimeter, but like takes this grainy aesthetic and brings it forward in a modern way. It doesn't feel like it's retro at all. It doesn't, it doesn't really have that sensibility. It's more of, like, just like a new take on kind of something that's really fresh and immediate.
There was a Q&A with the writer, Nick Pinkerton. We'll play that clip somewhere.
Yeah, you got a bit of that on your phone, so we'll put it in there.
And he has a great moment in there where he says, film isn't for any particular generation or something like that. You know, where, like, the feel of shooting something on film, you know, because, like, The Sweet East does kind of evoke like the 70s or the 60s or whatever, but it's modern. There's cell phones and everything. So it's like, but he says this great thing in that Q&A, which you'll hear, where he says like, that film isn't for a particular era.
Yeah.
You know, it's like for everybody. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. A lot of, I do think there is a misconception that, anything in terms of being shot on film is the past, and digital is now. It's the future, right?
Yeah.
But the, you know, these technologies are still very much in use and still being made. It's, you know, it's more expensive, but that's not necessarily going to change, like, you know, how you're shooting it. You know, it's the what, like, the only difference is in terms of the aesthetic and kind of what you're going for creatively, you know, plus the process and all that. But there was a sense of like, wow, like, I like how this looks, I like how it feels.
Yeah, the movement felt handheld,
totally. And yeah, Sean Price Williams was originally a cinematographer. Worked with the Safdie brothers and worked on, you know, with Alex Ross Perry. And so he comes from a very particular scene. And yeah, I found the movie to be really affecting and funny. And, you know, I was hearing a lot of things about it being kind of shocking and strange and weird. And I don't know, it doesn't really have that. It's like, not that it's not weird. It's just, it fits the vibe.
Yeah.
It works in a very particular way. So like, cool movie.
I like the very ending too. It kind of reminded me of The Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
Where like Lillian's at home after her crazy adventure, you know, getting through everything, surviving. And then there's like bombs dropping, or at some stadium, there's like some horrific event, and she like sneaks out, and you know, she even like gets a moment to look at the camera and kind of smirk and be like, I'm going out where the trouble is.
Yeah.
You know, because it's boring at home.
Right.
She needs to be on the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was fun. But yeah, that was a cool movie.
I'm really curious. It threw me off right at the beginning of the movie. But where did you guys get for singing the song come from?
That was, as I mentioned, it was, you know, a two-part bifurcated shoot. That came up late before we went back to shoot the second half. Our friend Paul Grinstead had this song, which is called I'm a Cat. And this was a Sean idea. I think partly he has a specific point of reference for it, which is escaping me now, but I think it also become pretty like besotted with this Grinstead song. And you know, speaking earlier of like, you know, the difference between the script and the finished product, this is one of the things that's not in the script, which adds something I think very essential to the film. So Grimstad, who is a academic in addition to being a songwriter, is also a big fan of Edgar Allan Poe. Tweaks the lyrics a little bit so that they're referential to a newspaper that Poe edited in the late 1870s, The Evening Mirror. And it just fit like a glove immediately. And I think it added something, well, it's something that had been in, you know, not only the first iteration of the script, but stuff we'd shot where you had a scene where Talia's character, where Lillian really expresses herself, really like disgorges her inner life. And that's in the script. We shot the scene. It's ultimately not in the film. It's the one moment now in the film where you have her alone with herself, kind of speaking for herself, and in a kind of oblique way, but in a way that I think is lovely and ultimately like superior to the stupid scene that I wrote.
So we're also so grateful that we get to present the film on 35mm film. I wish all films were still shot on film, but I think definitely shooting on film lends it a bit of a retro feel, simultaneously paired with very contemporary lingo. Like, can you talk a bit about your inspiration about that tension within the film?
I must protest here because, and I mean, this is the thing that's often said, it's, you know, this grainy 70s vibe. And point of fact, you know, Eastman Kodak's still making film. It doesn't belong to a particular period. I mean, I don't know, Christopher fucking Nolan is still reeling out movies on film. Like, and you know, maybe there are certain lighting choices that Sean makes that kind of suggest a certain moment in film history. But to me, like, this isn't some relic. It's, you know, not like, I don't know, it's not like we're releasing an album on player piano cylinders. Like, anybody can do it. And I mean, obviously, it's the case that it has, in some circles, been sort of judged as this sort of throwback thing, but I don't think of it as, you know, being so. Like, and this is no, Yeah, this is no stodgy, like, anti-digital thing, but for this particular, you know, project, like, film seemed like the right thing to do. We were, up until rather late in the game, going to shoot it digitally, and our wonderful producer, Craig Huda, Sean came to him rather late in the game, and heard they could look to shoot on film. And Craig, who, you know, knows Sean very well, has worked on many of the Alex Ross Perry films, unlike a great many producers, just like some 2 seconds of, okay, crunch the numbers a little bit, see if we can see about that. And, you know, we made it work. And, I mean, ultimately, you know, I don't want to get into splitting hairs over the thing, but I find that in my own film going life, things shot on celluloid tended to have a slightly different impact for me, and I've loved many films shot on digital, but this, I was very happy about that decision, though it was not one I was really privy to.
Well, we're happy about it too. So, knowing all of this about your experience as a screenwriter, are you going to write another screenplay?
I mean, nobody's really like knocking down the door. I mean, yeah, like, it's not like we're really in control of our own fates here. I mean, this is the thing I wrote on spec starting 6 years ago. This is the thing that, you know, we blundered our way into getting made. I don't want to reveal what the salaries were, but I will say we paid more to get the rights for the song Mr. Bane than either I got paid to write the movie or Sean got paid to direct and shoot it. So we're going to continue doing this, but you can maybe figure out a better system.
That seems totally fair, but I think maybe the rest of you agree with me. I'm hopeful that in 6 years, maybe we'll have another Nick Pinkerton film that we can share with everyone. But
yeah, may I briefly say, this is such a, like, this movie's been out in the world for a while. I got this invite to come to Milwaukee, and the issue is extended to Talia, Sean, myself, both, who had prior engagements. But what people don't know is I'm a Cincinnatian by birth and a very hardcore Midwestern nationalist. Milwaukee people. So when the opportunity dropped in my inbox, absolutely the last major Midwestern city I haven't been. I've been to fucking Toledo, Ohio, Champaign, Illinois. So I've completed the set. And I just want to thank you for that.
I'm gonna have to smoke out front. This
little yeah. So that same night, I you had to head home, but I stayed for In a Violent Nature, which I'll just give a quick.
I had a early morning, so yeah.
Yeah, no, like, and that's all good. Like, this movie would have put you to sleep.
Okay.
Now, maybe not in, like, you know, maybe it wouldn't have. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily saying that's boring. I'm just saying that it the movie is glacially paced. If you don't know what this is, it's a feature debut by Chris Nash called In a Violent Nature. It is a slasher film from the perspective of the slasher killer. It has a similar, like, narrative thread of, like, maybe Friday the 13th, like, part 2, where it's like the legend's already there. the, you know, Jason or the figure that comes back is kind of zombified or undead, right?
Yeah.
It has a certain scene towards the end where the main characters are trying to outsmart the killer and get a jump on it or whatever. So there's a lot of threads to previous slasher films, slasher history. It recalls a lot of that.
Interesting.
But since it's from the perspective of the killer and like you think, oh, okay, well, like it's just going to be nonstop killing. Well, no, like he has to walk. And what does Jason do? He walks, right? Yeah. And he just goes methodically. Like sometimes you think he's going slow, but he'll catch up to you real quick. And mm-hmm. so much of this movie is just walking and yeah. like experiencing the sounds of the forest and how like as the killer does sets up traps, goes like how he goes cool. about killing someone. It's a very like academic breakdown of a slasher movie.
Interesting. Yeah.
Like
parts of Rob Zombie's Halloween 2.
Yeah, like when I did
you see Michael just walking, yeah. just walking.
Yeah, just existing in the kind of the mindset of a killer, of a slasher villain is pretty unique. It's definitely not for everybody. I think people are going to be rough on this one. Not because it's bad, but just because it's really dedicated to moving at this certain pace.
Sure.
Giving you exactly this experience and not really catering to any, you know. Like, I think a lot of people will probably watch it via, like, a kill count video.
Sure.
And that's it. Like, I feel like they won't actually sit down and experience it. But there are a couple mean, vicious, over-the-top kills in this that I was really, like, shocked by. Chris Nass was originally, like, a visual effects. He worked with cool. practical effects. So, like, you can tell. It's so...
And there's one in particular.
Oh, yeah. There's one in particular that had... Basically, when it happened, the entire audience just was in disbelief, laughing, like, freaking out. And it continued for basically the entire next scene because we were all like, what did we just look at?
I didn't see it, but I've heard about it.
Yeah. So definitely check it out. I think Shudder has it. And it's IFC Films and Shudder. So
okay.
It'll be on your streaming services pretty soon. I think it's the end of May. It has cool summer vibes, like campfire vibes.
Yeah.
But it's slowed down to molasses in an interesting way.
Memoria.
So, I mean, yeah, the horror film version of we bring up Memoria whenever something's slow.
Horroria.
But like, in a way, it does make you consider what's going on in the frame, and like, it makes you think about those moments in a slasher movie where you're like watching your final girl, right?
Yeah.
And where's the killer? And it's like, you think about, man, I wish I could see, like, what is he up to out there? What's he planning? Where's he going? And this movie kind of gets into that. So,
sounds awesome.
One of my favorite slasher movies of recent years is a movie called Sick. It's on Peacock, I think. And it's like a COVID era slasher. It's about people who quarantine initially. And there's a killer who's out to get them. It's very Scream because it was written by Kevin Williamson.
Oh, cool.
And... This one had like a similar vibe where it was like it was, but in like a different pace. That one was like sprinting, like nonstop, ruthless, like tension and all that. And this one's like all the way slowed down in a cool way. Yeah. So I enjoyed it.
I'm
trying to think of what was the next one I saw. I went to see 100 Yards, which was fantastic. Oh, sure. That was a martial arts film.
Sounds cool.
Very, I don't know how to put it. It's like very kind of a ballet by the screenwriter of same person who wrote this, wrote The Grandmaster, the Wong Kar-wai martial arts film.
Okay.
So it's kind of about like a martial arts master and an apprentice and the son of the master who is jealous of the apprentice and how the son wants to, you know, kind of take control of his father's like martial arts school after he passes away. Mm. And there's a lot of I don't know, fighting that takes on an emotional kind of spiritual component, which is cool.
Nice.
So it's not The Raid. It's not, you're not, it's nothing like that. You know, it's pretty spectacular, set in the 1920s in China, I think in the northern area of China. So it was pretty good. I enjoyed it.
Nice.
I'm trying to think of the next one we saw together. Was it Riddle of Fire?
Riddle of Fire, I think, was the next one that we teamed up on.
But yeah, we saw. I saw this movie called Booger.
Oh no, we saw Close Your Eyes.
Oh yeah, we should talk about that.
Yeah.
I literally don't have it tagged on my Letterboxd because I haven't reviewed it yet because it's that good.
Yeah.
And I just don't know what to say about it.
No, totally.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Dude, Close Your Eyes is probably the best one, the best movie that I saw at the festival, though I liked Riddle of Fire more because it's fun and whimsical.
Sure.
And but Close Your Eyes definitely is that, like, it's that masterful cinema.
Yeah, so...
And it's about movies, it's about memories, it's about your unfinished life, you know?
Basically every heavy theme you could want in a movie is in this.
And the director...
Yeah, so Victor, I believe it's Rice. Arise. His first film, I think it was his first film, Spirit of the Beehive, which is very much an acclaimed international art house classic.
I've heard of it. Haven't seen it.
About two little girls who view Frankenstein at their local neighborhood theater and start to have delusions of a monster following them. And and it's like about the power of cinema and like magic at a young age. And awesome. Like when you live in a small, you know, town in Spain, when your memories are like so normal and like just kind of unremarkable, what happens when a movie takes hold of your subconscious, kind of a thing.
Kind of The Long Day Closes.
Very similar. I wouldn't have been surprised if Terrence Davies loved The Spirit of the Beehive. And it's focus on a child, and you know the ramifications of watching a movie at that age. So it's like, you think about it, it is larger than life, and it's scary.
And everything's real when you're a kid,
because
you don't know about special effects and things like that, and how to be like, that's not a real shark.
No, exactly. Like, and that movie really captures it really well. El Sur, which was a film that he was working on for a long time, and the budget was essentially taken away halfway through. So what was meant to be like a 3-hour epic of sorts is like 90 minutes. And even in its essentially unfinished state, it's a beautiful film about a young girl and the relationship with her kind of mysterious father. And I watched that right before Close Your Eyes because I had never seen it. And oh wow, like as soon as I started watching it, I was like, where has this been all my life? I know it's been on my watch list. Yeah. I know. Whenever you finally watch something that you've been meaning to.
Yeah.
And it's just, oh my gosh, it's like even better than you imagined.
It's so cool then how it also lands at a time in your life that's like more appropriate than if you had watched it right when you heard about it.
Totally.
Like how that works out sometimes with movies is incredible.
But yeah. He also made a documentary. But this is the Close Your Eyes is Arise's first film in 30 years.
Damn. He's only done 3.
And he's in his, I think he's like 83 now. So it's like, this is very much an old man cinema type thing. And this one's close to 3 hours. And it's essentially about a director and an actor who are making this movie. The actor disappears off of set and is never seen again. And the director goes on this true crime show like 30 years later to kind of deal with unfinished business, to talk about the gap in his life that he feels after his friend and an actor has disappeared. And then someone calls the show and is like, hey, I think I've seen this guy. I think I know where he is. And it kind of starts this mystery of like, where was he? Where did he go? And what happens when someone comes back into your life after so long? Mm-hmm. What does that mean for your art, for your person, yourself? What does it mean going forward? Like, is it a miracle? Is it a curse? Like, what is this?
And that actor gets amnesia or something. We find out, so he doesn't even remember like who he is or where he was or that he's lost or anything. But then it's kind of like, whose responsibility is it to repair that? Or should we, even if he's happy with the person he is in his life now?
There are immense layers to this movie, and it unfolds at just a beautifully deliberate pace.
It's like reading a book. It's like being read a book. And it's so interesting to think about some of the movies that we've watched that have been slow, like Memoria. And you know, I was saying, like, that's so slow, it almost, like, breaks the pace by just being real. So you don't feel like it's taking a long time because you're just looking out a window. Whereas, like, Close Your Eyes is slow, but it's more this like slow burn, and it doesn't even burn, you know, because there's not like action or anything. It's all just about like the journey to find this guy.
It does develop like that. There's a mystery, there's a narrative, the characters really go through these interesting, beautiful changes.
Yes, it's engaging the whole time, and it's slow, but in a way that's like made me think of The Wire, where it's like you're earning this journey and all the, you know, everything you're investigating, you earn it, and like it has to be slow so that you get the sensation of what it's like to go to these places and try to find this guy and uncover every rock, you know, and then feel like, well, maybe it's not him, you know. So the pace, it being 3 hours, is like, I feel like, purposeful to be able to get that feeling. And then 3 hours is like nothing when you're talking about a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, so actually it's a very short movie.
Yeah, the... It makes you just recalibrate kind of your senses when you go in. Like, it starts with a film within a film. And for a long time, you don't even know that's going to change. Yeah. So you start from a perspective of like, okay, this is just the movie. This is what I'm watching.
Yeah.
And then it takes you out of it. And it's such a beautiful break of like your immersion.
Yeah.
And you start to realize this movie is going to be about so much more than you were expecting.
It's very deep and, yeah, a lot of layers. But it doesn't feel like... It doesn't feel like you have to study it, you know, but it definitely feels like a movie that can be studied.
Yeah.
There's a lot of depth to it. Yeah. And it's really watchable for how long it is. Just like, I do connect a lot with when they're like going through their old boxes of like, you know, the footage and stuff and being like, oh, here are some mementos and things like that. Because I often am going through my old stuff, you know, as like a filmmaker or just an artist, you know, so.
And the things you make kind of become your past, you know?
Yeah.
Like that creates a document of your past. And I wanted to see this movie again. I ultimately had something else going on I couldn't make the second screening, but it was the one film of the festival that I truly tried to make an attempt to go again.
Yeah.
Because like, when else is this going to be back on the big screen? I don't know. I don't even know if it has U.S. distribution. I really hope it does. I saw that the U.K., like the U.K. BFI was showing it. So like, it's getting some screenings, but it is a special movie. And if you can find it anywhere, watch it, experience it. It's just nice and comfortable. Totally. It was a comfortable watch.
Yeah.
And by the end, I felt like I had been like fully... like just like rejuvenated, essentially.
Yeah.
The ending was so pure and beautiful. Yes. And yeah, absolutely the standout of the festival for me. But that doesn't mean there weren't other good ones. I caught up with The Beast. Beast now has a release that's at the Downer Theater, I believe, in the Milwaukee area. But I got to see it. This was the first, like, the premiere in this area.
That's cool. Didn't see it. Sounds cool.
Really interesting, evocative movie. We saw Riddle of Fire, which is, you know, to kind of expand on that, is like this whimsical, it's like if Harmony Korine made like a Alice in Wonderland type thing. It's funny, both the Sweet East and Riddle of Fire have like, I feel like, some textual similarities.
Definitely.
Both being shot on film and whatnot.
Yeah. And the, you know, the coming of age.
Mm-hmm.
The journey, like, I love the like modern fairy tale aspect about Riddle of Fire.
Mm-hmm.
And just thinking about like RPG video games and like D&D.
Yeah.
You know, it's very like quest driven. They're trying, you know, they gotta make this pie. The person who's making the pie is, you know, isn't there. They're sold out. Mm-hmm. You gotta get the egg to make the pie. You gotta go to this place to get the egg. The guy takes your eggs. You gotta follow him, you know, and the actors, the kids are like such rascals, super funny, whimsical, charming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've heard like a Goonies, like a modern Goonies, you know, and just that like kids being on an adventure and, you know, making their own decisions and like dealing with some hard stuff. And then also emotions and their friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Just super fun and like just incredibly watchable. I love that one the most.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. Of all
the stuff that I saw.
There's this one kid of the three kids that are the main focus of the movie who, like, he constantly mumbles his words, so yeah. They have him subtitled.
Yeah.
A very inspired creative choice.
Yes.
That, like, really makes everything he say, like, all the funnier when you, like, yeah. read it out. And you're like, why is he saying yeah. that? Like, what yeah. is so weird?
I keep thinking of the chilling, ghastly doll.
Highly recommend seeking this out wherever, you know, some of these movies mm-hmm. I don't even know, like, some of them you can rent. Like, I think The Sweet East is, like, you can rent now.
Riddle
you know?
Of Fire is also streaming.
Cool.
I've recommended it to some friends of mine for sure.
Yeah, seek it out. Really, really funny movie. And yeah, it has a lot of beautiful ideas about growing up and like, what you do in your childhood that resonates throughout your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the relationships with your parents, with your friends,
mm-hmm.
The community, and then yeah, then there's like magic.
It's wild, man.
Yeah.
It's a wild movie.
It's really great.
I won't spoil like when this needle drop comes in, but it has a cannibal Holocaust needle drop that I was gleefully happy about. Like, that's one of my favorite soundtracks.
Yeah.
And it's such a beautiful song for such a horrifying, horrible movie.
I didn't I didn't get the reference, but I heard the pop from you and some of our friends.
Yeah, we were like, oh yeah, let's go.
Yeah, so I knew it was something, and that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, and then the last film that we saw together,
yeah.
Which we also have a one-on-one interview with the director, is the documentary Chasing Amy.
Yeah.
Now, this is a movie that I won't say I was skeptical of, but a lot of these films, especially like documentaries that are about personal journeys, often, you know, I struggle with them. You know, it's whether how they're made or how the perspective is.
Yeah.
But the director, Sav Rogers, who is a trans man, this is a film about his transition. And it's also about how Chasing Amy was one of the first films that he saw that made him recognize, like, the elements of queerness and mm-hmm. made him feel comfortable and at home.
Mm-hmm.
He had a TED Talk about it that went viral. You know, Kevin Smith and Joey Lauren Adams
yep.
were reaching out and, you know, talking about, you know, his bravery and all this. And it is about, you know, not just him coming out as queer, but then eventually coming out as trans.
Yeah.
And the beautiful journey that he goes on in terms of reckoning with a film. Mm-hmm. And it's not a film that shits on Chasing Amy, as much as it does have a variety of perspectives where people recognize the flaws and, you know, I guess problematic elements of the
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
It's more about, you know, what do we find in art that sometimes is less than perfect? And
yeah.
what does it mean to someone at a certain point in time that can literally save lives, you
yeah.
know? And I found it incredibly emotional, and Sav Rogers was a joy to talk to.
Yes.
And we, and you know,
Riley.
And Riley, who is his partner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's a movie that's not just about Chasing Amy or about Sav's transition, but it's also about the love story that he has with her.
Yeah, so great.
It was charming and delightful, and yeah, it doesn't. I don't think as of this moment it has distribution yet. I really hope it gets picked up.
It was super interesting. In our Q&A before we watched it, I say a thing about how, like, I didn't really pick up on a lot of these themes.
Mm-hmm.
And Chasing Amy is one of my favorite of the Kevin Smith films. You know, I felt like it was his most mature,
mm-hmm.
but it's like it's talking to straight guys.
Yeah.
And so it kind of like accidentally is illuminating all these things about the queer community, and that is like a problematic, like, it's not talking about them in the best way because it's like through the lens of a straight guy.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm a straight guy. So I was taking the movie like, hey, this is about me. This is for me. Like, I get it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then to see Chasing Amy was so great. Cause it's like, whoa, there's like all this stuff that is so obvious that, like, how didn't I pick up on that? But it's like, I'm not, you know, I'm not thinking of it being problematic because I'm on the one side of it, you
right.
know? So it was really cool to, like, to kind of get, like, smacked on the head, you know, and be like, open your eyes. This is so obvious. Like, even, you know, 20 years ago, should have seen some of these, you know, some of the ways that it's, like, not great representation of the queer community. But,
Well, the
so, yeah, Chasing Amy was great.
It's awesome because it doesn't quite, you know, it doesn't shit on the movie. It lets you know that, you know, there are characters in this movie where they're out and queer and proud of it. And there's not really a moment that relegates them to a certain type. But at the same time, it does have problems with, like, navigating, like, you know, being bi or being queer and like having, like, this understanding of identity in this time when a lot of guys just, like, didn't get it and thought and were upset about it and, like, were constantly in their feelings over sexual history and things of that sort. The movie does come from that very particular place, and I think that's, you know, one of the many downfalls of the movie, but also one of the reasons why it's done so well is because it has that limited perspective. You know, Kevin Smith didn't have a lot of traps to fall into because he's really only writing from his very limited experience.
Right.
So, you know, it captures the essence of that movie, how he was, like, around a bunch of Sundance people. You know, he was around the people who were making Go Fish and the new queer cinema of the 90s. And so, you know, to make a film, like, when he was hanging out with all those people was, like, it makes sense. Like, and it's crazy to think that the Kevin Smith of now initially was that kind of a darling, you know, up there with the, you know, in the same kind of group as the Paul Thomas Andersons and the the Finchers and all that around that time. It's pretty interesting.
That the Joey Lauren Adams solo interview in Chasing Amy is probably the best part.
Yeah, you know, no,
it, like, the rawest, like,
it's so raw. Like, well, because it doesn't just talk about her experience, which she clearly has a lot of unfinished business because her and Kevin Smith were together and had a falling out and a breakup, and and a lot of this movie is about their relationship, which can't be easy for her. But also, she talks about the Weinstein of it all and the culture of you know, just seeing all these major filmmakers like Kevin Smith soar and a lot of the filmmakers that he not stole from but took influence from and was around kind of flounder and not get money for their next movie and have a small little bit in the spotlight, but that's it. So you know, she doesn't hate Kevin, clearly, but there is a toxic culture that she kind of illuminates in this movie, that, you know, that she expands on in a very interesting way, and all these threads come together. You know, all these different angles of this movie, it makes for an exceptionally satisfying film. Yes. A work of criticism, a work of identity, you know, in talking about, you know, a transition and becoming the best person of yourself, the best version of who you can be. So many beautiful moments in it. So yeah, we'll throw in a quick interview here and as well as a Q&A with Sav Rogers, so you guys can listen to that.
William, nice to meet you.
Corey,
nice to meet you.
Yeah.
This is Riley, star of the film.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
We're here. We're queer. Ready to talk.
No, fantastic.
Here, you know.
So we are podcast co-hosts of a podcast called Another Look with Will and Corey.
Okay.
We talk about a film each week where we think deserves another look, recontextualizing everything. Looking at stuff from a different lens, established classics to guilty pleasures.
Yeah. Well, we have nothing in common then.
I think we wanted to start, just like as a basic question, is like with Chasing Amy being in your life for so long, like, is this a movie that you come back to still as like something that you feel like deserves another look? Is it something that you would want to share, I think, with a new audience? Because like this movie is about that, but it's also not. Yeah. So, like, I'm curious as to your thoughts on it.
I feel like I've done enough work over the last 5 years to get people to consider recontextualizing Chasing Amy.
Yeah.
And so I like for the film to kind of stand on its own in that way. I don't think I need to do any further work on Chasing Amy personally, right. Mm-hmm. But I hope that people watch it and then they watch Chasing Amy. I hope that they, you know, consider it through my lens and the lens in which I viewed it, mm-hmm. but also consider the various perspectives that are within Chasing Amy that ask you to look at it differently or to consider the time in which it was made. You know, I don't think that the idea of like something aging poorly is particularly interesting to me because, you know, films are all a product of the time in which they were made.
Right.
And I think it's really interesting to look at that as a piece of history and as an archive, and what information was available there versus like, well, it doesn't hold up by our different standards today. But I think that's a good thing because you see the progress in which has been made since then. So I don't think any film is perfect except maybe Parasite.
Yeah.
Everybody seems to agree on that.
Yeah, Parasite is great.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, it's all a more nuanced conversation. And I'm excited for people to see Chasing Amy. And in 20 years, let's see the conversations we're having about that too.
Chasing Amy.
God, I hope not.
Keep chasing Amy.
Yeah, Chasing Amy was my favorite Kevin Smith movie, like, coming up. I mean, I super like Mallrats. Jay and Silent Bob maybe is because it's, like, the most, like, lore-heavy in the View Askew universe, you know? But, like, but Chasing Amy always felt like a more mature, like, Kevin Smith film. But then, so I haven't seen it in a while, so it's going to be really great to watch your film, Chasing Amy, because, like, I don't remember picking up on, like, any of the stuff that I think, you know, is going to be illuminated through, you know, your work. So, like, I'm excited for that.
Yeah, but I think that's what's beautiful about Chasing Amy is that you can watch it and you can get a lot of different reads on it. You know, 10 people go into a room and 20 perspectives come out on Chasing Amy.
Yeah.
I think that's the sign of a complex film, a nuanced film, and an honest film. So I'm really excited for you to get to see it through this lens and for us to talk about it. You know, it's cool.
No, that's fantastic. I think jumping broadly to just both of your work in general, like how does it feel, I think, to share this movie with the world? Is it hard to like have a film that's so connected to like your experience and also be talking about like another movie? Do you find that tension when you're kind of moving through the festival circuit and all that?
I think it's been an incredibly gratifying experience in my opinion, because we have gotten to like screen in so many places all over the world, and we have gotten to like meet people that have driven hours from like rural places that just come here to like watch this movie, and then like are so earnest and so thankful and so grateful to us. And it's like parents of queer kids, and it's like parents that didn't have movies like this either growing up, and it's been just like so humbling and just so incredible to live this, because like you said, it's our story that goes along with the Kevin Smith movie, with the Kevin Smith personal story, with the Joy Luna story. So it's everything is just so intertwined that like, while it is difficult because it's like it's raw and it's emotional, it's also been incredible, and there's like no words to describe how like thankful we are that people have let us into like into their hearts. And like
I mean, and to answer the second part of your question, I think I feel the tension more than you do, maybe, in terms of like the personal and the professional all kind of being mixed together. Just because it's so raw, and like I wasn't intending on being in it this much, and at the outset of the project, I wasn't intending on being in it at all.
Yeah.
And so to go through the journey of like, you know, preserving parts of yourself that you wouldn't want preserved for the rest of the world to hear for all time or to see for all time, you know, in terms of me transitioning, or to make mistakes and to do that on screen. It's a lot more enjoyable to watch other people come of age and fictional characters come of age than it is to see that reality reflected back at you. But
oh yeah, there's parts of the movie that are still like excruciating to watch. Like I don't like watching. Like his TED talk or things where he talks about, or like seeing him in pain is just like, I obviously don't like to watch those things.
I think, I mean, I haven't seen it yet, so I am speaking from a place of like just knowing what the context is, but I'm sure that like the harsh elements make for a more interesting journey in terms of understanding what this movie is by the end, like knowing how to go forward and like, I don't know, developing your own thoughts about the film and yourself in real time.
Well, and it's because it's true, you know, it's that truth is what's gratifying. You know, there's a version of this movie that's just all bullshit and publicity, and it doesn't have those real conversations that we have in the movie. And that wouldn't be nearly as interesting as watching people contend in real time with their real feelings. And those are complicated feelings. And so I'm really thankful to everybody who participated in the documentary, who let us into their homes, who let us into their, you know, minds by, you know, having conversations, because nobody had to do this. Everybody elected to do this. And I think the result is something beautiful and complicated, just like Chasing Amy is.
That's fantastic. Well, we won't take up any more of your time, but we really appreciate this.
Of course.
On-air handshake.
On-air handshake is kind of a thing we do.
Oh, there we go.
Very good. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Because you could be talking to anybody, and you're talking to us.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Really excited to watch the film.
We like it.
Stick around after. We'd love to talk more.
For sure. And hope you enjoy Milwaukee, too.
Yeah, it's so cool. This is one part of the Midwest I hadn't been able to get up to. I think I can like finally check off all of the Midwest on my bucket list.
No, the writer of Sweet East, Nick Pinkerton, was here. And he was like, I got an email saying that I was going to be able to go to Milwaukee. He was like, I'm all over that, which I thought it was so cute.
This is the first U.S. state that I've been able to go to that I hadn't been to before.
Wow.
As a result, I've been to a lot of places around the Midwest. Like, we got to go to Europe and stuff. We had never done that before.
Wow.
We finally have gone to Milwaukee. It's Wisconsin.
Yeah, there you go. You got it. So cool. Hear the deer, baby.
Let's go.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
One more on here. Handshake.
Sure. Hell yeah.
Another one.
Great job. Thank you.
Hope you like it. Thanks so much.
The Sav Rogers Q&A afterwards is really great. And there were some really good questions from the audience too, and I was really impressed just with, you know, to be like, these people are representing the film community of Milwaukee, and they're asking some like intelligent questions.
It was one of the best Q&A's I'd ever been to, especially whenever a Q&A opens up to the audience, I'm like, oh no, because it's like, hey, do you have any advice, first time filmmaker, or why did you do that, you know, like these dumb like questions that like if you just think about it for like 10 seconds you'll figure it out,
right?
But these were questions from an audience who watched the movie, wrestled with it, and were looking for answers in a way that was like furthering the conversation, enriching the conversation about the movie.
Yeah, and these audio recordings are exclusive to the Another Look podcast. You can't get them anywhere else.
Nowhere else. And, you know, they might sound a little bit off the cuff and maybe not the best audio quality, but you're going to get some exclusive sound bites. So,
and Sav Rogers shouts out the library.
Yeah, and we all know that's our number one sponsor.
We love the library over here on this podcast.
Please welcome the stars of Chasing Amy and director, producer, writer, all the things, Sav Rogers and Riley Rogers. Oh my God.
Hello. Wow, thank you all for being here. Wow. I'm here. So nice.
That was beautiful. Thank you, Milwaukee. Thank you so much. All right.
Well, yeah. You're telling me.
So, after the cameras stop rolling, once you put down the mouse and stop editing, the story goes on and your life continues. You catch us up to today. How you been?
For asking. We were thankful to premiere at Tribeca 2023, and for almost the last year we've been on the festival circuit just getting to meet rad audiences and, you know, to just keep connecting with people, and it's been great. Like, my childhood dream was just to talk about Chasing Amy with people, and now careful what you wish for. But it's been good.
That's awesome. Has the film been in Mexico City yet? Have you been able to go back?
No, we haven't been to Mexico just yet, but I'm very excited to make it happen.
Our festival rep, Kathy Suska, is in the audience from the Film Collaborative. So, Kathy, can we make this happen? Thank you so much.
Yes. All right. Mission accomplished. Very good. Very good. So I do want to talk about, obviously, there's a lot of incredible faces, and looking at all of the subjects, I'm like, that person who we all love, this person, Andrew Ahn, all these amazing people that you got to talk about the film with. How did that process begin to get that wonderful family of people?
It's a great question, because that was the question I was asking myself in September 2018, being like, how do you reach any of these people? Keep in mind, I was a year out of film school, had absolutely no credibility, and I would like cold call places, you know, like I called John Sloss, who's Kevin's lawyer, and you know, was the production counsel on Chasing Amy. And I was like, hello, is John Sloss available? And they were like, who is this? And I was like, hi, I'm making a documentary about Chasing Amy. And they're like, who are you with? And I was like, self-finance. Thank you so much. There we go. All right, we'll hold the center. That it just became a series of cold calls, and so we were able to get somebody like Bob Hawke. You know, it was a small world. Like the theater owner at TED, when I was working at TED for the TED residency, his uncle was Bob Hawke, and he just loved coming to see TED Talks. So he was in the audience for the TED Talk, and it was like a very small world. But a lot of cold emailing, a lot of who are you. A lot of perusing Outfest, being like, hey, do you know Winifred Turner? Would you think you could help me get in touch with her? And thankfully, you know, people were kind and wanted to participate. And if they didn't want to participate, they weren't in it. And that was fine.
Damn, that's how you make a documentary. That's incredible. That's amazing.
5 years, only 5 years later, bam.
Here we are.
Easy.
Yeah, and congratulations on nearly a year on the road and all of that. That's really remarkable, incredible.
Thanks.
That's amazing. Another question that kind of came to mind throughout the film is what things don't get included? Obviously, you are sharing a lot about your life on screen. Are there any moments that you're like, this is too much, I need to keep myself separated from this a little bit? How do you keep that? How?
Great question. It's a question I ask myself a lot in post, because contrary to what you just saw here, I was not planning on being in the movie. And you might say, well, Sav, how did you get all this footage of yourself if you weren't planning on being in it? Which is also a story. I had initially not planned on being in it at all, and I was using my personal story as leverage to try to get people interested in, this is why you should care about Chasing Amy. And every question I would get, whether it was from a funder or somebody who wanted to be a production assistant or whatever, they were like, well, you're gonna be in it, right? And eventually I conceded to being in it as much as Bing Liu is in his beautiful film, Minding the Gap. If you haven't seen it, it's a gorgeous movie. He's in it just enough to not be like self-aggrandizing. And that was my reference point of like, this is what I would like for it to feel like. And so we were getting coverage of me everywhere we went, just in case we would need it, because we didn't know what we would need in the edit just yet. And when we got to post, like, everybody else had figured out it was a movie about me, except for me. And so everybody was, you know, I was like, all right, we're going to make the movie we said we were going to make. And they're like, no, we're going to make the movie that it has become. And so we had tried my version of it, where I wasn't in it very much, and it was not good. Spoiler alert. If I could have gotten away with making that version of it, I that would be the version you would see today. But I felt really safe with all of the incredible teammates that we had, including, there were a lot of names that you just saw. And they all played an invaluable role in helping shape it and helping me feel safe to tell my story. And so in terms of stuff that was left on the cutting room floor, it was anything that was not about my specific relationship to Chasing Amy. Anything else, whether it was like interesting facts about New Queer Cinema, or, you know, an interesting part of an interview that was like, oh, this is some kind of like cool film history, or this is a fun fact about Chasing Amy, it would be scrapped, because then it felt...
Karen Smith talking.
Yes. You'll wait for the Blu-ray for that. Other than that, you know, what we have is in there. So I don't regret anything being left on the cutting room floor. And I think, you know, for as much as everybody in that movie talks, including Kevin, we did a pretty good job summing up their viewpoints and making like these hours long conversations feel, you know, like you were in it with us.
Absolutely. And for Riley, when did you get to see the completed film for the first time?
I watched it about 1 month before we premiered in Tribeca, and it was a very, very unexpected experience, because even though I had been like kind of going along with the process, never ever in a million years would I have expected that this was the final project, because it had so many stories, like the parallels, everything, even knowing everything that I knew about it, like even having kept like myself like away from the process, wanting to be a little bit surprised, I was like putting all my bias aside, I was like, hey, this is a really good movie.
And it is. Yeah, it's so fun to, especially at these screenings, to kind of come into the audience and see people aggressively nodding to moments that I knew, like, oh, I knew the audience is gonna very much agree to this. Have you gotten to see audience reactions, and kind of what's the feeling with that?
So typically I stand in the back of the theater for the first 5 minutes until you get to the Chasing Amy title card. And I know if they laugh at a certain moment, that will be okay. And everybody will like understand the film. And it's the John Oliver Ben Affleck joke. And I'm like, all right, if you're on board with this, I think you're on board with the rest of the movie. So yeah, I mean, it's been really great. I've only sat in all the way through twice, just because it's still kind of raw for me. Cause like, you know, we were there. So I sat in for the world premiere at Tribeca, kicking and screaming. I did not want to do it, but I was glad I did it. And then at Outfest Los Angeles, we were closing night. It was a group of 900 really rowdy queer people. And they just kept surprising me as an audience. And I was like, well, I have to sit. Clap breaks when Guinevere Turner makes a fisting joke. Like, it was that vibe. And so that was great. So every audience has been different, and you know, so I usually catch the beginning and the end, and then, you know, usually there's more team members here who are like, they laughed at the right moment, this is perfect. Okay, when we go back for the edit, we're gonna leave an extra second here for the audience to laugh, whatever. Which has been lovely.
Good, I'm glad that you also can acknowledge that you need that distance from the film and the story, and just some time to, you, like you both have said, you were there. You lived it and went through it. I am gonna open the floor for audience questions. If there is anything already that's been up, yes, right here.
First of all, thank you for the movie. It's really a good movie. I have a couple of questions. First of all, did you try to get in touch with Ben Affleck?
Yes.
Okay. And my second question is, what's the plan for the movie going forward? Thanks. When is it going to be available for a wider audience, and do you actually plan to release a Blu-ray?
First of all, physical media forever. If you love a movie, please buy it. Own a movie. If you do not own it in your hands, do not let our corporate overlords tell us what is good. Other than that, corporate overlords, please buy our movie. That's where we're at. So thankfully, in the last month, I would say we've gotten a lot more distribution interest, because now people are asking the question, wait, you guys haven't been purchased yet? And so people are kind of coming back around. It was a hard time, you know, on the heels of the pandemic and also the WGA strikes. Everybody's been really afraid to buy anything, which includes the documentary sector for some reason. So hopefully you'll be able to buy it soon, see it in a movie theater, see it on streaming, et cetera, et cetera. We want this film to be available as widely as possible for as many people as possible. That's how I stumbled on Chasing Amy. I just happened to have a physical media copy. But, you know, there are tons of queer kids out there. There are tons of people who could use a story like this to let them know, hey, you have a future, and it's going to be fine. And also, we all love movies, right? So hopefully you get to see it at your local library, too.
Hell yeah, physical media. Yes. We're still open. We're still open for questions.
What's your next story?
Oh, there's a bunch of those in the pipeline. I'm excited to be able to just like focus on telling a new story. Ideally, it'll be a narrative film. I don't think documentary film is for the faint of heart, and I'm a sensitive little guy. So I'm hoping that in addition to some doc pitches that we can get my first narrative feature financed, and I think we're well on our way to doing that. But it'll be daffy, fun, and optimistic, and if you like Barb and Star, go to Vista Del Mar. That's the kind of stuff I want to do.
Yeah! Yes, absolutely. We'll see you there. It'll be here. Trust and believe. We've got more. Right here.
I'm curious, Kevin Smith has seen the movie, but most importantly, what his reaction was to the
Joe Warren and Ingrid, because that's probably the most wrong person.
Yes, terrific question. So basically, around the time Riley saw the movie, after we had locked picture and, you know, we had sent off our DCP to Tribeca, I gave Kevin the opportunity to watch it, as I tried to do with all of the primary participants. Just send them a link and let them have like an open dialogue with me, because I didn't want them to influence the final edit. You know, we tried to be as respectful as possible while also balancing the multitude of truths in this movie, sometimes conflicting. And so I was really nervous for Kevin to see it, not just because, you know, he's in it, this is his real life, and there are stakes in it for him, but also he's the guy who made me want to be a filmmaker, you know, by making Chasing Amy. So, you know, having to have that separation, but also, like, I really like the guy. He's very charismatic and likable. And so, you know, and he showed me so much support. I was like, I hope this paid off, you know? And so I was prepared to live with the consequences of whether he liked it or not. So, all that to say, I sent him the link to the movie, and I said, just FaceTime me when you're done. I have a panic attack for 92 minutes. And, you know, Riley is trying to calm me down, all of that, you know, good stuff. And then Kevin calls me mid-panic attack. I answer, and before I can even say hello, he goes, I loved it. And for 56 minutes, we talked a lot in detail about what he responded to. The first thing that he loved was our love story. He's a romantic at heart, and he really just like fell in love with you. And you know, you were standing off camera, so you heard all the compliments. And the second thing that he loved the most was the Joey interview, which was really surprising to me, because that's hard to hear from anybody, let alone, you know, an ex-partner, especially that raw and vulnerable. And while I cannot speak for Kevin or anybody else in this movie except for myself, I think there was a sense that, you know, he was there. He knew what their relationship was like, and I think, you know, he basically understood his role in all of it. But he thought it was, you know, really raw and really compelling and really made the movie. He ended it by saying that it was one of the best movies about movies he'd ever seen, which, like, what do you even do there? Yeah, I mean, yeah. I love it. Way in the back there, hey, friend.
So I kind of lost my voice a little bit, but hopefully you can hear me. Because of this really deeply personal story and the vulnerability it required from the both of you over the course of a significant amount of years, what did, and I hate to use this buzzword, but hey, what did and does self-care look like during that journey, and now having to relive it over and over again through Q&As, press tours, things like that?
Hugs.
Hell yeah.
Therapy, lots of bugs. I think I have to have some separation from it, where when I'm present, I am present for it, and when I go home, I'm not thinking about Chasing Amy. I think there was a reason I did not want to be in it. Part of it is documenting my transition on camera was not my idea of fun, was not my idea of how I wanted people to remember me. I want people to know me as the person I am now. And so that was really vulnerable and kind of difficult. The other part is just like watching yourself make mistakes in real time. You know, it's a lot more fun to watch other people make mistakes, like all of you did tonight, than it is for me to see myself do it. And so when I go home, I just try to be present with you, and, you know, with the family, and think about new ideas for the future, because I've been living in Chasing Amy land for the last 20 something years, and I'm really excited to tell a new story.
You've given, so far in this Q&A, two of my all-time favorite answers, yes and pugs. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
I'm very good at this.
Yes. We have time for one more question from the audience, and then we will. Yeah, right here in the aisle.
Yeah, I was really intrigued when this is kind of a story of generations and the impact of storytelling through time, because even from where your story started to where it ended, it shifted, but then you also saw this reverberation of a very specific story and point in time in all of the people who were involved with Chasing Amy. And I also think you really got some deep reflection from people who were involved with what was going on in indie film, with Miramax, with Weinstein. I'm curious, since this has come out, like, were you surprised by getting that story on film from these primary people, and what some of the industry reaction has been? Because presumably when you went to Tribeca, there were a lot of people there who had maybe been around all those years ago with the start of the story.
It's a great question. I knew that we would have to talk about Harvey Weinstein as soon as that story broke. But we didn't want the film to be about Harvey Weinstein because, you know, the fact that his name is on Chasing Amy, that isn't the thing that makes it special. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a film from the 90s that, you know, had a major impact in culture that his name isn't on. And so he is not the thing that made any of those films special. Those filmmakers are. You know, you look at Frida with Selma Hayek, you know, the hard work she did on that movie, nothing to do with him. It's in spite of him, in fact. So we knew that we would have to talk about it, but we talked a lot about how to handle it, how much to put him in. You know, there were some producers on the team that are like, we don't even want to name him. We don't want to show his face. We don't want to do any of these things. But we also wanted to make sure that it was contextualized for an audience because not everybody knows who he is. So it was a difficult, you know, conversation figuring out, okay, how much do we put it? Because the main thing is that we wanted to honor Joey's story. You know, Joey talking about this really difficult shit that took a lot of bravery to be able to talk about, especially in an industry that's so relationship-based. She stuck her neck out there talking about this. And so I'm forever indebted to her and grateful for her for opening up about that. I was not expecting that. You can kind of see it all over my face in the interview. It's not the direction I thought it was going to go. But it's important to be able to share our truths like that. And to be able to hear those truths. In terms of industry reactions, you know, pretty much everybody's like, yeah, he's a monster. He's been a monster the whole time. I think people are surprised that the interview happened and unfolded that way. But I think, you know, I've gotten a lot of support for the movie, and I'm really grateful for that. Nobody's been like, that didn't happen. That'd be kind of wild at this point. So yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, and just kind of like, the you had a really interesting interchange between the filmmaker who was also up at the same time,
yeah,
and the through lines of sort of who was making these decisions,
yeah.
And so I thought that there was a very powerful story there that I haven't seen. I vaguely remember when Clerks came out and seeing Clerks, but kind of contextualizing last, what dare I admit, 30 years.
Mm.
And all these overlapping stories. So I guess bravo to you for doing that, for doing that stacking and layering and make it come together really nicely.
Thank you. I'm honestly just grateful that anybody cares.
Amazing. On a brighter note, I would love I'd love to hear what's next for the film and what's next for you outside of Life of the Movies.
We're just trying to keep getting the movie out there to, you know, to keep getting our story out there and to go back home to the pugs.
The pugs.
Yeah, I miss the pugs. We've been on the road for a while. What's next is hopefully closing a distribution deal that that gets the film out there in the biggest way possible, and continuing to connect with audiences in person. So regardless, we would love to keep doing non-theatrical screenings, community screenings, getting it out there just so that people have an opportunity to see it. And then what's next is hopefully making a fun, a highly specific story that, you know, makes you feel a little bit better when you walk out of the theater. That's what I want to do. And hopefully we get to do it together and with a lot of the same people we got to work with on Amy. So I'm really thankful for getting to be here and for y'all platforming our film like this. It means a lot.
Well, we look forward to that film and everything afterwards. Thank you so much for giving so much of your time.
Everyone.
But yeah, no, it was a really successful film festival. I'm trying to, know, if this is pretty off the cuff podcast. There's plenty of films I could go in detail for another hour or two, but
yeah,
we don't need to
do. Do you remember working the film festival when we worked at the theater?
Absolutely.
What was that like?
hell.
Dude, it was nuts.
you gotta always, I'm giving a shout out here to the volunteers of the Milwaukee Film Festival who go there to get free movies and to be immersed in the culture and the community of Milwaukee and its great film scene. Shout out to all those people, and also shout out to every frontline concession, ticketing person who has to deal with the barrage of crowds that the Milwaukee Film Festival gets. You know, it's not Sundance, but it's a big festival, and there's a lot of people in small spaces and spaces that aren't necessarily, you know, used to that sort of thing. So shout out to all the people slinging popcorn, cleaning the theaters, switching out the marquees.
Going into that back room to cry just a little bit before you get back out to the rest of your shift.
It happened to us, and you know, for us being there as like press, we were eternally grateful for everybody working to keep it running smoothly. And it, man, everything went well. It was a great festival, absolutely. And bless you.
Thank you.
And on that note, you have anything else to say, Corey?
No, I think that's it.
Yeah.
Just yeah. Great festival, bunch of sweet movies.
Yeah, keep a lookout for any of those, honestly, that we talked about. You know, some of them might have already made their way to streaming. Some might, you know, start trickling their way onto streaming or in theaters soon. So, you know, keep a lookout for them. A lot of good stuff in the independent scene. You know, we talk about blockbusters. We talk about small movies, everything in between. So, just keep listening, and we'll be back with more.
Super cool.
Yeah, on-air handshake.
On-air handshake. Very good.
And I'll see you later.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.